Hey everyone, thank you for listening to K Voice of Resistance. That's the letter K, Voice of Resistance. I'm your host, Kelly. I'm currently in Vietnam right now, eating my fill of pho.
For those of you, if you don't know what pho is, it's a Vietnamese soup that answers the question, what happens when a former child soldier pours hot rainwater over fish nightmares? It's delicious and I can't stop eating it. That's what happens. That's what happens.
Thank you, Kyle Kinane. So I'm sorry if I am not talking about the most up-to-date news. I thought it would be good to review disaster capitalism. After all, we just had a massive shock event, and disaster capitalism will be what we are at risk of falling prey to. So I referenced something called the Davis-Bacon Act in this episode, and there is some bills moving through the House and Senate that are based on this act that I thought I'd give you a heads up on. In the House, introduced by the oh-so-charming Steve King.
I mean, I'd ask you to go back through history and figure out where are these contributions that have been made by these other categories of people that you're talking about? Where did any other subgroup of people contribute more to civilization?
Than white people?
Than Western civilization itself. It's rooted in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and the United States of America, and every place where the footprint of Christianity settled the world. That's all of Western civilization.
But what about Asia? See, white supremacy is nothing new in our government. His bill is in committee. This bill is called H.R. 743, the Davis-Bacon Repeal Act. This bill repeals the Davis-Bacon Act. The Davis-Bacon Act requires that the locally prevailing wage be paid to various classes of laborers and mechanics working under federally financed or federally assisted contracts for construction, alteration, and repair of public buildings or public works. References in any law to the requirement under the Davis-Bacon Act should be null and void. Basically, they don't want to pay government workers a minimum wage. That's right. Your Republican lawmakers hard at work, fighting for our interest. And because this absurd bill is not enough, we do have an identical bill moving through the Senate. S-224, brought to you by Mike Lee of Utah. Fantastic.
The water had come in, wash everything I had down the street.
As environmental problems rise, and more problems rise beyond that, we have to be prepared for what our government is going to do. Shock.
Shocking.
I don't think I could sit down right now.
You mean...
Historic, astounding, shocking.
It's a word that's come up a lot since November, for obvious reasons.
He's going to inject a shock to the system.
At the most chaotic juncture of Iraq's civil war, a new law is unveiled that would allow Shell and BP to claim the country's vast oil reserves. Immediately following September 11th, the Bush administration outsources the running of the war on terror to Halliburton and Blackwater. After a tsunami wipes out the coast of Southeast Asia, the pristine beaches are auctioned off to tourist resorts. New Orleans residents scattered from Hurricane Katrina discover that their public housing, hospitals, and schools will never be reopened. These events are examples of the shock doctrine. Using the public's disorientation following massive collective shocks, wars, terrorist attacks, or natural disasters to achieve control by imposing economic shock therapy. Sometimes, when the first two shocks don't succeed in wiping out a resistance, a third shock is employed. The electrode in the prison cell or the taser in the streets, the rapid-fire corporate re-engineering of societies still reeling from shock. This did not begin with September 11th. And it has not ended there, either.
10 years ago, I published The Shock Doctrine, an investigation that spanned four decades from Pinochet's U.S.-backed coup in 1970s Chile to Hurricane Katrina in 2005. I noticed a brutal and recurring tactic by right-wing governments. After a shocking event, a war, a coup, a terrorist attack, market crash, or natural disaster, exploit the public's disorientation, suspend democracy, push through radical policies that enrich the 1% at the expense of the poor and middle class.
That is Naomi Klein, author of the book, The Shock Doctrine, of which I highly recommend everyone check out.
This is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare.
We are going to cut taxes and simplify the tax code.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
Now, some people have said that's exactly what Trump has been trying to do. Is it true? Well, sort of. But in all likelihood, the worst is yet to come. And we'd better be ready.
We already know. that Donald's administration plans to deregulate markets, wage an all-out war on radical Islamic terrorism, trash climate science, and unleash fossil fuel frenzy. It's a vision that can be counted on to generate a tsunami of crises and shocks. Economic shocks as market bubbles burst. Security shocks as blowbacks from foreign belligerents comes home. Weather shocks as our climate is further destabilized. And industrial shocks as oil pipelines spill and rigs collapse, which they tend to do. Especially when enjoying light touch regulation. What's even worse is the way that Donald's administration can be counted on to exploit these shocks politically and economically. That's relevant because of the central, if little recalled, role played by the man who is now U.S. Vice President and Christian warrior, Mike Pence. Naomi Klein explains that at the time Katrina hit New Orleans, Mikey Pence was chairman of the powerful and highly ideological Republican Study Committee. On September 13th, 2005, just 14 days after the levees were breached, and with parts of New Orleans still underwater, the RSC convened for a fateful meeting at the offices of the now infamous Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Under Mikey Pence's leadership, the group came up with a list of, quote, pro-free market ideas for responding to Hurricane Katrina and high gas prices, unquote. 32 policies in all, each one straight out of the disaster capitalism playbook. The first three items on the RSC list are, quote, automatically suspend Davis-Bacon, prevailing wage lawsuits in disaster areas, unquote. A reference to a law that required federal contractors to pay a living wage. Let me say that again. They suspended a law that forced contractors to pay employees a living wage.
Ugh, you gotta be kidding me.
Make the entire affected area a flat tax-free enterprise zone, and make the entire region an economic competitiveness zone. Comprehensive tax incentives and waiving of regulations. Others were to streamline the environmental hurdles of building new oil refineries, make it easier for small refineries to increase capacity, allow more offshore drilling, allow drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, temporarily suspend the gas tax, encourage production of renewable fuels, biodiesel and ethanol, encourage private market projects to recover usable energy from oil shale, strengthen the existing investment tax credit for enhanced oil recovery. Another rule called for giving parents vouchers to use for charter schools, a move perfectly in line with the vision held by our now education secretary, Bible schoolmarm Betsy DeVos. Klein writes, all these measures were announced by President George W. Bush within a week. Under pressure, Bush was eventually forced to reinstate the labor standards, though they were largely ignored by contractors. There is every reason to believe that this will be the model for the multi-billion dollar infrastructure investments that Donald is using to court the labor movement. Repealing Davis-Bacon for those projects was reportedly already floated in a recent meeting with leaders of construction and building trade unions. The oil industry wasn't the only ones to profit from Hurricane Katrina.
Of course not.
So did a slew of well-connected contractors who turned the Gulf Coast into a laboratory for privatized disaster response, or lack of response, as it were. And, hate to surprise everyone, it was a failed experiment. The companies that snatched up the biggest contracts were a familiar gang from the investment of Iraq. Halliburton's KBR unit won a $60 million gig to reconstruct military bases along the coast. Blackwater was hired to protect FEMA employees from looters. Parsons, infamous for its sloppy Iraq work, was brought in for major bridge construction at Project Mississippi. Fluor, Shaw, Bechtel, CH2M Hill, all top contractors in Iraq, were hired by the government to provide mobile homes to evacuees just 10 days after the levees broke. Their contracts ended up totaling $3.4 billion, no opening bid required. And no opportunity for profit was left untapped. Kenyon, a division of the mega funeral conglomerate, Service Corporation International, a major Bush campaign donor, was hired to retrieve the dead from homes and streets. The work was extraordinarily slow, and bodies were left in the broiling sun for days. Emergency workers and local volunteer morticians were forbidden to step in and help because handling the bodies infringed on Kenyan's commercial territory. And as with many of Donald's decisions so far, relevant experience often appeared to have nothing to do with how contracts were allocated. Ashbridge, a company paid $500 million to remove debris, reportedly didn't own a single dump truck.
Jesus Christ.
And farmed out the work. Even more striking was the company that FEMA paid $5.2 million to perform the crucial role of building a base camp for emergency workers in St. Bernard Parish, a suburb of New Orleans. The camp construction fell behind schedule and was never completed. When the contractor was investigated, it emerged that the company Lighthouse Disaster Relief was actually a religious group. Lighthouse's director, Pastor Gary Haroldith, confessed, quote, "About the closest thing I've ever done is just organize youth camp with my church," unquote.
So why'd you take the job?
After all the layers of subcontractors had taken their cut, there was next to nothing left for the people doing the work. For instance, the author, Mike Davis, tracked the way FEMA paid Shaw $175 a square foot to install blue tarps on damaged roofs, even though the tarps themselves were provided by the government. Once the subcontractors took their share, the workers who actually hammered in the straps were paid as little as $2 a square foot. Davis wrote, quote, "Every level of the contracting food chain, in other words, was grotesquely overfed, except the bottom rung, where the actual work is carried out," unquote. In Mississippi, a class action lawsuit forced several companies to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in back wages to immigrant workers. Some were still not paid at all. On one Halliburton KBR site, undocumented immigrant workers reported being wakened in the middle of the night by their employer, a subcontractor, who allegedly told them the immigration agents were on the way, and most of the workers fled to avoid arrest. This corruption and abuse is particularly relevant because of Donald's stated plan to contract out as much of his infrastructure spending to private players and so-called public-private partnerships. In the Katrina aftermath, the attacks on vulnerable people carried out in the name of reconstruction and relief did not stop there. In order to offset the tens of billions going to private companies and contracts and tax breaks, in November 2005, the Republican-controlled Congress announced that it needed to cut about $40 billion from the budget. Among the programs that were slashed were student loans, Medicaid, and food stamps. In other words, the poorest people in the United States subsidized the contractor bonanza twice. First, when Katrina relief morphed into unregulated corporate handouts, providing neither decent jobs nor functional public services. And second, when the few programs that directly assist the unemployed and working poor nationwide were gutted to pay those bloated bills. This is the disaster to capitalism blueprint, and it aligns with Donald's own track record as a businessman as well. Donald and Mikey Pence come to power at a time when these kinds of disasters, like the lethal tornadoes that struck the southeastern United States, are coming fast and furious. Donald has already declared U.S. a rolling disaster zone, and the shocks will keep getting bigger, thanks to the reckless policies that have already been promised. What Katrina tells us is this administration will attempt to exploit each disaster for maximum gain. We'd better get ready. The good news is that there is hope. The first step to combating these shocks is knowing not just our own history, but the histories of the rest of the world. And so we know when shock politics has been thwarted by the people and how they did it. I am of the mind that this will be the greatest test for our movement, for the resistance. And when the shocks come, it will be up to us to step back and hold back the red tide. Naomi Klein has also laid out 5 rules for us to follow when the time comes. We will get to those tips.
It was dark at midnight. People began to holler and scream.
From man-made disasters to natural disasters, to financial shocks, to terror shocks. One thing is inevitable. Bad things happen. In Paris, France, in 2015, 3 coordinated attack teams set out in Paris to kill as many people in various emblems of daily Parisian life. First was at a packed football stadium. Luckily, The terrorist was not able to get through security, so the bomb was detonated outside the stadium and only killing the terrorist and one passerby. The explosion could be heard inside the stadium. At the same time, 15 people were killed in a hail of bullets by an automatic weapon as they dined at a restaurant in the center of town. That was followed by 5, and then 19 killed at even more locations. The deadliest attack of the night, however, came at a concert venue. The 1,500-seat Bashikon Hall was sold out. 89 people died as men fired Kalashnikov-style assault rifles into the crowd. In response, the socialist president, Hollande, issued a state of emergency.
Mes chers compatriotes, au moment où je m'exprime,
Hollande convened a special congress for what was to be 3 months. He made changes to the French constitution, one of which would enable France to protect itself from dual citizens who might pose a risk, and increase military attacks against ISIS. Hollande's state of emergency banned political protest. It was a concert, a football stadium, and restaurants that were targeted, yet only outdoor political activity was not permitted. And that state of emergency, under which Human Rights Watch found repeated abuses against ordinary people during policing operations under emergency powers, the state of emergency decree was extended again and again until it had been in place for over a year. And now, President Macron has sought to extend it through November. In France, a state of emergency is now the new normal. France also deployed throughout the city over 10,000 troops under what was known as Operation Sentinel. After the London bombing at the Ariana Grande concert in May, the conservative Theresa May used the attack to lie about her opponent, Jeremy Corbyn, who, I am pleased to say, kicked butt in the election despite this dire proclamation.
This choice that people face at the general election has just become starker. It's a choice between me working constantly to protect the national interest and to protect our security, and Jeremy Corbyn, who frankly isn't up to the job.
In addition, UK's terror threat level, that delightful system, was raised to critical, its highest level. In the aftermath of the attack, the controversial Operation Temporaire was activated for the first time, allowing up to 5,000 soldiers to be deployed to, quote, augment armed police officers engaged in productive security duties. Not only that, the Conservative government declared that any expectation of privacy in digital communications was now a threat to national security and began working with cyber companies to gain backdoor access to encrypted platforms like WhatsApp, and even stronger calls by the government to crack down on internet privacy after the London Bridge attack were made. In the case of France, after the Paris attacks, those actions were taken under a center-left government. And as Naomi Klein, the author of The Shock Doctrine, points out, we would be naive to assume that Donald and Mikey Pence would not, in the same name of authoritarian protection, jump at the opportunity provided by an attack to shut down political action, deploy troops, reduce rights to privacy, and who knows what else. Klein believes that protests like the ones that we had after the Muslim ban, where the roads and airports were blocked, would be strictly banned and protest organizers would be targeted, surveilled, arrested, and imprisoned. And in the courts, our friends, the courts. Remember after the judge struck down the Muslim ban, Trump tweets that said, just can't believe a judge would put our country in such peril. If something happens, blame him and the court system, unquote. The courts may be less likely to take a hard line in the defense of what is right in the face of lost American lives. And then there are the large groups of people that are at risk of being rounded up. It's happened before. The Japanese internment camps were in our not-too-distant past. Investigative journalists, Black Lives Matter protesters and organizers, Hispanics, Muslims, and even climate activists are all at risk. It is crazy to think that these things are possible, but at this point, a whole host of things are possible and have already been done that I have never imagined before. Klein makes the point that in the name of freeing the hands of law enforcement to fight terrorism, Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions were finally, how that excuse has been looking for to do away with federal oversight, a state and local police, and set them loose. Especially those localities that have been accused of systemic racial abuses. The full weight of Donald, Mikey's, and the GOP's more radical agenda has not been fully enacted, or even attempted. But make no mistake that it is decoupaged onto Donald and Bannon's stream wall, waiting for its first national shock, such as a terror attack, to be made real. And it is about as cynical as a thing as I have come to understand about anything.
Wall Street's worst day since 9/11. The Dow plunging more than 500 points. The S&P down almost 5%. The wreckage unprecedented.
We had a sharp sell-off in stocks on Wall Street today.
Lehman bankrupt.
When Scott Soft-Hands Walker got elected to be governor of Wisconsin, he used the state budget crisis to strip the hardworking laborers of union bargaining rights in 2011, catapulting him to the prettiest girl at the Republican ball. The only man in America to follow God's rule about not touching himself, Mike Pence, met with Scotty just after the 2016 election to hear from the Republican hero exactly how it was he screwed over the voters. The Republicans, and now Donald, are already working to get Medicare, Medicaid, SNAP benefits, well, any social program that helps the people, but they are constrained from doing so completely. After the 2008 crisis, banks were never broken up, and now the Republicans are giving a green light to banks to bubble our way to another market crash with dismantling of the already decimated Dodd-Frank and the onslaught of deregulation. The bubble that we were already heading towards will once again burst, and Donald's banking buddies will not be on the hook.
We will.
Naomi Klein explains that it will not be in the first year after the new crisis, the new shock, that we start seeing their truly insidious economic plans be realized, but it will be when the new budgets are made to recover from the crisis. Quote, then in the name of rescuing the government and perhaps the entire economy, the White House will start checking off the more challenging items on the corporate wish list. Unquote. Social programs? Gone. DeVos's charter school and voucher programs? In. Minimum wage? Gone. Or at least slashed. Tax hikes for the poor? Of course. Tax hikes for the rich? How big? For big business? Better believe it.
We need to focus on what this administration will do when it has a major external shock to exploit. Maybe it'll be an economic crash like 2008. Maybe a natural disaster like Sandy. Or maybe it'll be a horrific terrorist event like Manchester or Paris in 2015. Any one such crisis could redraw the political map overnight, and it could give Trump and his crew free rein to ram through their most extreme ideas. But here is one thing I've learned over two decades of reporting from dozens of crises around the world. These tactics can be resisted. And for your convenience, I've tried to boil it down to a five-step plan. Step one, know what's coming. What would happen if a horror like the one in Manchester took place on U.S. soil? Based on Trump's obvious fondness for authoritarianism, we can expect him to impose some sort of state of exception or emergency, where the usual rules of democracy no longer apply. Protests and strikes that block roads and airports, like the ones that sprung up to resist the Muslim travel ban, would likely be declared a threat to national security. Protest organizers would be targeted under anti-terror legislation, with surveillance, arrests, and imprisonment. With public signs of dissent suppressed, the truly toxic to-do list would quickly bubble up. Bring in the feds to pacify the streets. Muzzle investigative journalism, you know he's itching to.
You weren't called. Sit down.
The courts, who Trump would inevitably blame for the attacks, might well lose their courage. And the most lethal shock we need to prepare for? A push for a full-blown foreign war. And no, it won't matter if the target has no connection to the attacks used to justify it.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
Preparing for all this is crucial. If we know what to expect, we won't be that shocked. We'll just be pissed. And that's important for step two. Get out of your home and defy the bans. When governments tell people to stay in their homes or show their patriotism by going shopping, they inevitably claim it's for public safety, that protests and rallies could become targets for more attacks. What we know from other countries is that there is only one way to respond.
Hundreds of Tunisians have been defying the curfew in the capital, Tunis.
Disobey en masse. That's what happened in Argentina in 2001. With the country in economic freefall, the president at the time declared a state of siege, giving himself the power to suspend the Constitution.
Decretado el estado de sitio en todo el territorio nacional.
He told the public to stay in their houses. Here's what they did instead. president resigned that night, and eventually new elections were held. 3 years later, in Madrid, a horrifying series of coordinated attacks on trains killed more than 200 people. The prime minister, José María Aznar, falsely pointed the finger at Basque separatists and also used the attacks to justify his decision to send troops to Iraq. His rhetoric was classic shock doctrine. Division, war, fear, daddy will protect you. This is how Spaniards responded. They voted out Aznar a few days later. Many people said they did it because he reminded them of Franco, Spain's former dictator. Which brings us to step three, know your history. Throughout U.S. history, national crises have been used to suspend constitutional protections and attack basic rights. After the Civil War, with the nation in crisis, the promise of 40 acres and a mule to freed slaves was promptly betrayed. In the midst of the pain and panic of the Great Depression, as many as 2 million people of Mexican descent were expelled from the United States. After the Pearl Harbor attacks, around 120,000 Japanese Americans were jailed in internment camps. If an attack on U.S. soil were perpetrated by people who were not white and Christian, we can be pretty damn sure that racists would have a field day. And the good folks of Manchester recently showed us how to respond to that.
People in Manchester don't stand with your xenophobia and racism.
Something else we know from history. Step four, always follow the money. While everyone is focused on security and civil liberties, Trump's cabinet of billionaires will try to quietly push through even more extreme measures to enrich themselves and their class, like dismantling Social Security or auctioning off major pieces of government for profit.
Today we're proposing to take American air travel into the future.
It's in those moments when fear and chaos are sucking up all the oxygen when we most have to ask, whose interests are being served by the chaos? What is being slipped through while we're distracted? Who's getting richer? And who's getting even poorer?
When the floodwaters were still rising in New Orleans, one of the first official acts that the governor did was to fire all the teachers. What's happening is a raid of the money set aside for public education to be given to private companies. It wasn't by happenstance, it was by design. You saw the political manipulations and taking advantage of the crisis.
But if we learn from this history, we could actually make history with step five, advance a bold counterplan. At their best, all the previous steps can only slow down attempts to exploit crisis. If we actually want to defeat this tactic, opponents of the shock doctrine need to move quickly to put forward a credible alternate plan. It needs to get at the root of why these sorts of crises are hitting us with ever greater frequency. And that means we have to talk about militarism, climate change, and deregulated markets. More than that, we need to advance and fight for different models, ones grounded in racial, economic, and gender justice, ones that hold out the credible promise of a tangibly better and fairer life in the here and now, and a safer planet for all of us in the long term. Defensive actions alone won't cut it. There has to be a different vision, and it needs to be bold. Saying no to the shock doctrine is vitally important. But when the shit hits the fan, no is not enough.
Stay tuned for part two of the Disaster Capitalism series next week. It's the best half, if you ask me. You're not going to want to miss it.
Thank you for listening to my show, K-Voice of Resistance, on the Crab Diving Network. That's at crabdiving.com, C-R-A-B-D-I-V-I-N-G.com. That's one word, under the K-Voice tab, or download my show as a podcast. And you can also find my show on Citizen Truth at citizentruth.org. Follow me on Twitter at Kelly the Voice, and of course, follow me on Facebook at K-Voice of Resistance. All right, take care of yourselves out there, and as always, resist.